You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Tragically, there's an average of one mass shooting per day here in the United States, and given the ineffectiveness of the gun control lobby, my guest today says it's time for a strategy with some spine. That's why Professor Alan J. Lichtman of American University is proposing that America repeal the Second Amendment. That's the title of his new book, in which he uses history, legal theory, and up-to-the-minute data to make a compelling case for the amendment's repeal in order to create a clear road to sensible gun control in the U.S. And today, Alan Lichtman returns to the podcast to reveal that our modern interpretation of the Second Amendment as the right to bear arms is a relatively new idea, and he goes into the history of the National Rifle Association, from its origins as a group intended to improve marksmanship in 1871 to the powerful special interest group that it's become today. He explains why he feels it's necessary to repeal the Second Amendment and clarifies that it doesn't mean a ban on private gun ownership. He talks about why the outrage following every mass shooting quickly devolves into inaction by politicians, how to make the gun regulation lobby more effective, and debunk some of the myths about gun violence propagated by the NRA. Plus, the man who has successfully predicted the last 8 elections shares what his data is saying about the 2020 race, why polls are failing us, and he offers his thoughts on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Coming up with Professor Alan J. Lichtman in just a moment. Alan J. Lichtman is Distinguished Professor of History at American University and the author of many acclaimed books on U.S. political history, including White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, FDR and the Jews, and The Case for Impeachment. Now he's out with his latest book titled Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Professor Lichtman, welcome back.
Thank you.
Last time we talked about your previous book, The Case for Impeachment. So before we get to the new book, I'd love to get your impressions of the Senate impeachment trial so far.
It's been devastating for Donald Trump. You know, the Republican defenders of him are really down to their last ditch line of defense because they know what he did. Everybody knows what he did. Of course, he was conditioning aid and the White House visit on political investigations to help him win in 2020. The notion that he was fighting corruption is absurd. He never mentioned corruption in any of his phone calls. His own administration had certified they had met corruption benchmarks. He never reviewed corruption. In fact, he broke the law, according to the General Accountability Office, by not informing Congress of what he was doing. If he was fighting corruption, certainly he would have could have easily gone to the Congress. So they're down to their last line of defense. Well, maybe he did it, but it's not impeachable. And that depends on an entirely bogus argument by Alan Dershowitz, who's not an historian. He's not a constitutional scholar. He's a trial law advocate, and he completely gets the framers wrong, saying, you know, it had to be a crime, or later he changed that again and say crime-like. Not a single framer ever said anything like that. They all talked about abuse of power, treachery, perfidy. corrupting the election. They talked about that. They talked about seeking foreign influence. So they're down really to very little. And you can see how desperate the president is, resorting to his usual personal attacks on John Bolton, because the last thing he wants is John Bolton to appear. You know,
right.
The president's lawyers have been saying, no eyewitnesses, no eyewitnesses. That's not true. But here now you have a willing, perhaps the best possible eyewitness, because he was always there in the room with Trump.
Well, let me ask you this then. What happens if Bolton says, yes, I'll show up, I'll comply with a subpoena and testify, but Trump claims executive privilege? Can the White House stop a willing witness from testifying?
I don't think so. Look, I'm not a lawyer, but 15, 16, 17 other witnesses testified. Trump couldn't stop people in his administration like Gordon Sondland or Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. They went ahead and testified. John Bolton's a private citizen. He could go right ahead and say, I don't care what Donald Trump says.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he's not real happy with Donald Trump, who has been personally trashing him, and I'm going to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe Trump could seek a court order, or maybe we'd get a ruling from the guy who's sitting right there, right? The Chief Justice of the United States.
Right, right.
Uncharted territory.
Yeah, I wonder what you think of these two counts. Is the second one a harder case to make simply because, you know, they can say that it's obstruction, but the White House does have the right to work its way through the normal judicial process?
The second one is a harder count. It's much harder for people to understand the legal intricacies. People can certainly understand Trump extorting or bribing the president of Ukraine to cheat in the 2020 election. Remember, this is the guy who welcomed and exploited Russian interference and even openly asked the Russians to hack in illegally to Hillary Clinton's email. That people can understand.
Yeah.
You know, the second one is a little hard, but you understand why they did the second one, because they don't want Trump to get away with this idea of absolute immunity from anything Congress may do. He never claimed executive privilege, by the way, not once.
Right.
So you litigate absolute immunity. It'd probably take you right through the election, mooting the impeachment. And even if you won before the election, Trump just starts the process all over again by then claiming executive privilege. So this litigation idea brooded by the president and Republicans, it's a trap.
So if they decide to have witnesses and then this has to work its way through the courts, that might be Trump's preferred situation, right?
It might be, you know. He desperately doesn't want witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Look how much information has come out since the articles were voted by the full House.
Mm-hmm.
Emails released under freedom of information.
Mm-hmm.
Documents. Not even going to discount the testimony of Lev Parnas, but documents and recordings released by Lev Parnas. And now, of course, the John Bolton bombshell and the general Government Accountability Office report that Trump broke the law. You can't withhold congressionally appropriated funds without going to Congress. All the information that has come out since impeachment has been negative. None of it exculpatory. All of it incriminating.
Right. But I mean, purely from a political strategy, it might be best for him, perhaps, if he can extend this through the election so that these things don't come out ahead of time, regardless of whether he would get impeached or not.
You're absolutely right about that. I don't think, even if he claimed executive privilege, it would take that long.
Oh, really?
In this very special case where Bolton, unlike in the House investigation, Bolton has said, I will testify if subpoenaed. And the information's already out.
Yeah.
It's already there in the public domain, so where's the privilege?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another constitutional issue covered in your latest book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. I'll tell you, Alan, this book could not possibly be more timely given the epidemic of gun massacres in 2019. If I'm just going by what I see in the news, it definitely seems like mass shootings are happening way more frequently than they did 10 or even 5 years ago. Is it just that they're getting more attention now, or has there really been a significant spike in gun violence, and particularly in these mass shootings?
There definitely has been a spike in gun violence and mass shootings. Let me give you an example. In the Dayton shooting last year, Dayton, Ohio, a gunman armed with a semi-automatic weapon killed 9 people and wounded 17 in less than 40 seconds.
Wow.
Less than 40 seconds. That's more dead than in the entire year in the country of Denmark, the entire year in a country of about 6 million people, which has very, very tight gun controls. But while mass shootings are horrific and capture our attention, they are but the tip of the iceberg of gun violence in America. 15,000 annually, approximately, murdered by gunfire.
My God.
But even more die from suicide by gunfire. Another 23,000 plus. That's 40,000 when you throw in accidents. 40,000 gun deaths a year in America. That's just extraordinary. In terms of gun murders, an American is more than 20 times per capita, adjusting for population, to be murdered by gunfire than residents of our peer democracies in the G7 nations plus Australia.
You know, I'm not aware that guns have suddenly become more available over the past year. Maybe I'm just not paying attention. So to what would you attribute this increase in shootings?
I think the much greater availability of deadly weapons.
Okay.
Particularly semi-automatic weapons, like the one used in Dayton Massacre and the most horrific massacres we've seen in this country. Nobody needs a gun capable of firing 50 rounds a minute. You don't need it for sport. You don't need it for hunting. You don't need it for self-defense. It's a military weapon designed to kill as many people as quickly as possible.
And every time that there's one of these gun massacres in the U.S., there's probably about a maximum of a week of outrage, a lot of bloviating by politicians, calls for stricter gun laws. But then inevitably, it all peters out until the next shooting happens. Why haven't we been able to sustain the outrage and turn that into action?
Well, this is the critical thesis of my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. There's a reason I focus in on the Second Amendment. You know, everybody blames the lack of action on reasonable gun control. We're not talking about confiscating guns needed for self-defense or sport or hunting. So it is not, as everybody thinks, the money and political clout of the NRA. Lots of other interest groups spend far more money than the NRA. It is the Second Amendment. The NRA has hijacked the Second Amendment to claim an unlimited right to keep and bear arms. They don't care who gets guns, drug addicts, people prone to suicide, gangbangers, drug cartel people. Doesn't matter. Anyone can get a gun, according to the NRA. And that's not, for over 200 years, how the Second Amendment was understood. In fact, an internal memo from the NRA itself that I discovered, it was unknown before this, from 1955, said the Second Amendment only protects a collective right for defense through a well-regulated militia. That's not some left-wing group. That's not gun controls. That's the NRA. What happened then? You've probably heard, or maybe not, about the famous revolt in Cincinnati in 1977, when militants took over the NRA. They then hijacked the Second Amendment and distorted its meaning to claim that it protected unlimited right to bear and keep private arms, completely at odds with what we understand about the framing of the amendment and its history. And the problem is, the gun control movement has fallen into that trap. Instead of, as I recommend, and repeal the Second Amendment, the case for a safer America, they should take on the Second Amendment directly. They have the lame playing not to lose response. Well, we support the Second Amendment, but you know, we also support gun control. That inspires nobody.
Okay.
It doesn't work and hasn't.
Okay, because I was going to ask you, why can't we just change gun laws without repealing the Second Amendment? Are the kind of laws that you're proposing in direct conflict with the Second?
Yes and no. Since we don't really know anymore what the Second Amendment really means.
Right.
For the first time in history, in 2010, the Supreme Court bought into the NRA argument and recognized that the Second Amendment does protect to a certain extent the private right to keep and bear arms. But we don't know to what extent it is, because there just isn't very much Supreme Court interpretation. But we do know that Donald Trump has stacked the courts with pro-gun advocates, including probably now a majority on the Supreme Court. The other thing is, as I said, the strategy doesn't work. We haven't passed a national gun control law in a quarter of a century. And the last law, the assault weapons ban, lapsed in 2004.
Right.
So the movement has stalled. It's going nowhere. We need a new direction. And even if we don't succeed in repealing the Second Amendment, it would give new energy, new direction, new life to the movement. As John Paul Stevens, the great late justice himself, argued in a 2018 New York Times op-ed piece. That was the piece that inspired me, actually, to write this book.
When you say repeal the Second Amendment, you don't mean a total gun ban, because there's already a problem of gun owners equating any sensible gun control reforms with a total gun ban. And, you know, they're going to hear this and think no Second Amendment means no guns, period. And it's a fairly easy assumption to make, perhaps, especially when the NRA is talking in people's ears. How do you cut through the confusion and the inevitable spin that the NRA is going to put on this?
Yeah, that is pure nonsensical spin. As I said, we didn't have until 2010, for over, 120 years, we did not have a Second Amendment that had anything to do with the right to keep and bear private arms. No one confiscated anyone's guns. Guns for self-defense, for sport, for hunting, of course, were perfectly safe and reasonable. All that led to was reasonable gun controls like the assault weapon ban or the Brady Bill on background checks. If you repeal the Second Amendment, it simply opens the path for reasonable gun control that can't be overturned by a conservative Supreme Court. It in no way calls for the confiscation of guns. Not a single reform that I've advocated in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America, talks about confiscating guns. I'm talking about things like universal background checks, ban on assault weapons that nobody needs for any legitimate purpose, ban on high-capacity magazines, you know, 30-round magazines that nobody needs for legitimate purposes, permit laws like we have, red flag laws, not the confiscation of guns.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. The majority of Americans, and indeed the majority of gun owners and even NRA members, favor some kind of compromise on guns, such as background checks and a ban on automatic assault rifles, high-capacity cartridges. Yet the NRA's stance on gun control is way out of step with the majority of gun owners and their own members. Why doesn't the NRA ever fear alienating their own members?
Well, they have to an extent, but the money keeps pouring in. The NRA's a racket. Do you know how much they pay their CEO? $1.4 million. That's way out of line for a nonprofit, supposedly educational organization. They have six or seven other people making somewhere north of $600,000. And they're not generous in their pay to ordinary employees. They've become a money-making, money-siphoning racket. And that's what they care about. And they believe that if they compromise on guns and compromise on the Second Amendment, they're going to dry up the sources of revenue that have made their top leaders so very rich.
Interesting. And you also get into this fascinating history of the NRA. I didn't realize it had been around for so long. I guess it goes all the way back to 1871. Back then, was it always this powerful, big money gun lobbying organization that it is today?
No. And here's the irony of the NRA. The NRA constantly reels against big government. The NRA is not just a hammer on gun control. It's a hammer on any kind of liberal or even moderately conservative policies. It's become the hammer of the American far right. And they roundly denounce big government handouts. Well, the NRA was a dying organization in the early 20th century, as I point out in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment. You know how it was revived? By government handouts. It formed a partnership with the government, becoming, in effect, a semi-governmental organization, with the government supporting it for, in turn, helping the government with marksmanship programs that were established at the time in the early 20th century that the Dick Act established the National Guard. And it got loans of guns and ammunition from the governments, free targets, free ammunition, in some sense, free guns. That didn't end until well into the 20th century.
And I think that you say in here that the kind of the big moment for gun control was right around 1968 when we had this rash of assassinations. That was when the momentum for gun control really picked up. How did that peter out? What happened?
Well, as I said, in 1977, you got the militants taking over the NRA and using the Second Amendment now for the first time as a hammer against gun control. You are violating the Constitution. You are violating people's right to self-defense. Of course, that's utter nonsense. You're violating the sacred trust of the founding fathers to have people bear arms so they could check a tyrannical government. Utter historical nonsense. You know as well as I, the Federalists who framed the Second Amendment were huge law and order guys. The last thing they wanted was ordinary citizens to rise up. And in fact, in the Whiskey Rebellion and the Freeze Rebellion, which were rebellions of ordinary citizens against their government, what did they do? They invoked the Second Amendment to call out the militia and to put down what they saw as internal insurrections. And by the way, there are so many historical arguments as to why the framers never intended the Second Amendment to be more than establishing a well-regulated militia. But here's the telling argument, I think, irrefutable. James Madison, framer of the amendment, Southern slaveholder, right? Southern slaveholding states had to ratify the Constitution or it never would be put into effect. Do you think for one moment that Madison, other slaveholders, even people in the North who are prejudiced against blacks, would have supported an amendment that gave black people in America a right to keep and bear arms? Of course not.
Yeah,
but
good point.
Black people were excluded from the militias.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get into the militias legally until the Civil War. So by the fact that this is only for a well-regulated militia and not for private arms, that keeps black people from getting arms. If it were an amendment like the NRA, you know, a couple hundred years later said it was, to provide everyone a right to keep and bear arms, it never would have been supported by James Madison and the Southern slaveholding states.
Well, I want to talk about some of the arguments that the gun lobby makes. The NRA promotes this idea that, you know, America is just full of gun-toting heroes, and gun ownership is actually reducing crime and fatalities. Is there any evidence to support that?
Zero. As I said, the best evidence is to compare the United States with other advanced democracies. We're not talking about, you know, Guatemala or El Salvador. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, you know, Japan, Australia, Canada, France, the United Kingdom, Denmark. As I've said, and these statistics are in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. An American is 20-some-odd more times per capita to be murdered by a gun than a resident of our peer democracies in the G7 group of nations plus Australia. To believe the NRA, you would think, because we have such looser gun controls than these other nations, that we would be the safest of advanced democracies. We are the least safe by a huge margin. Also, when you look at gun suicides are vastly greater. An American is seven times more likely to die from a gun suicide than these peer nations, but we're 40% less likely to die from suicide by other means. NRA doesn't want to hear about suicide.
Yeah.
Here's why gun suicides are different. They're 90% effective. You know, poisoning or cutting, that's 2% effective. You know, you can pull that trigger in an instant, and once you've done it, it's gone. Over 23,000 gun suicides a year, more than even the number of gun murders. The other thing you can look at, and it's in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America, is to compare the strictest gun control states in America with the least strict. And the comparison is striking. Even controlling for education, race, urban, rural, anything you want, the gun murder rate and the gun death rate is a fraction in the tight gun control states as compared to what it is in loose gun control states.
And you also draw a remarkable contrast between the U.S. and Australia, which enacted much stricter gun control laws following the mass shooting in Tasmania. What's been the impact of that legislation?
Gun murders have declined in Australia. They are per capita but a tiny fraction, like 5% of what they are in the United States. In fact, the NRA wrote an editorial criticizing the Australian gun control, say, there will be blood because defenseless citizens won't have guns and the criminals will. You know, that's one of their stock talking points. Well, in fact, since they wrote that editorial, the number of gun murders in Australia, which is very small to begin with, has gone down, while the number of gun murders in the U.S. has climbed by over 1,000.
The other side has an obvious fundraising disadvantage against the NRA, but are there other things that the gun control lobby should be doing better?
Yes. Well, I think they are realizing the importance of fundraising. They actually, for the first time in recent history, the gun control movement outraised the gun lobby in 2018, largely because Michael Bloomberg, you know, the guy who's
right,
tens of billions of dollars, put a lot of money into it. So they need more Michael Bloombergs. You know, there was an amendment that was repealed. It was the Prohibition Amendment. This is not without precedent. And one of the critical things was the turnabout of John D. Rockefeller Jr., who had been a strong advocate of prohibition.
Right.
So you need to get more big money into it, and you need to reinvigorate the grassroots, which is why I'm saying you're not going to do that with a we support the yes, but argument. You can do that by following Justice Stevens' suggestion and going directly after the problem, which is the Second Amendment. You know how many other nations have the equivalent of a Second Amendment? One. This is in my book.
Really?
Guatemala, which is, you know, one of the most violent nations
yeah,
on earth. That's it. We are totally an outlier.
Wow.
And again, people's guns aren't being confiscated elsewhere, but they do have tight gun controls, which have reduced gun murders and gun suicides to but a fraction of what they are in the United States.
Wow. Still, since 1789, there have been, I want to say, close to 30,000 efforts to amend the Constitution in Congress, but only 27 amendments have passed, and only one amendment has ever been repealed, as you just referenced. It requires a two-third vote in the House and Senate, so it's designed to be difficult. Do you feel at all like you have the odds stacked against you?
I think we probably do. I'm not going to, you know, coat this with a rosy color. It's going to be extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I went to Brandeis University, as the great Justice Louis Brandeis once said, the most worthwhile things seem impossible at first. You know, who would have thought 30 years ago that a conservative Supreme Court would have said there was a constitutional right to gay marriage? You know, a tiny fraction of the American people supported the right to gay marriage. Now the vast majority do. So things can change. And by the way, while there has only been one explicit repeal of an amendment, There have been lots of constitutional changes that have repaired defects in the Constitution. For example, under the initial Constitution, the second highest vote getter in the Electoral College was vice president. That was changed with an amendment that led to the ticket system.
Right.
In the original Constitution, the state legislatures picked senators.
Mm-hmm.
That was changed with an amendment to the Constitution to pick senators by popular vote. So the Constitution is actually a bit more malleable than the conventional wisdom might have us believe. Am I saying it's going to be easy? Of course not. It's a huge uphill climb, but it's a worthwhile climb. And even the movement, I'm hoping, will reinvigorate the push for gun control, even if we don't actually get the repeal of the Second Amendment.
Is there anyone in the House or Senate who has signaled a willingness to take up this cause and lead the effort for repeal so far?
No one really has come out, but there have been some politicians who talked about this. There was a resolution introduced in the Hawaiian state legislature by a number of politicians on repeal of the Second Amendment. But you know politicians aren't going to be the first to move.
Sure.
You've got to get the constituents involved. Mm-hmm. You've got to get the grassroots. And as you said, you know, 80% support a lot of the gun control measures that have been discussed in recent years, like universal background checks, assault weapons, and high-capacity magazine. So there's a lot of room to mobilize here. And you also point out the NRA has begun to alienate some of its members. There are some pretty angry members and former members of the NRA who, in fact, you know, could become part of a real grassroots push. You know, The Onion, a satirical magazine, had a wonderful headline that I note in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Talks about mass shootings, and it says, "Nothing can be done about this in the only nation where this happens regularly."
The other way to amend the Constitution would be to hold a constitutional convention. Giving the public support for this, do you think that that route might actually be the path of lesser resistance as opposed to putting it to Congress?
Could be. I think constitutional conventions are dangerous, though.
Yeah.
Because who knows, you know, what mischief might be done to the Constitution.
Yeah.
So I haven't pushed for that.
Okay. So what happens after your repeal? Is that it, or is there still more work to be done after that?
Oh, there's a lot more work to be done. Two things would happen. One, you'd protect reasonable gun control measures, and that's all I'm talking about. I will repeat ad infinitum. Nothing in my book recommends, suggests, or even hints at the confiscation of guns or that you can't have guns for reasonable self-defense, hunting, sports, shooting. I'm talking about things like universal background checks, gun permits, gun safety laws, red flag laws, assault weapon and high capacity magazine bans. So the first step obviously would be to, and I think if you got repeal the Second Amendment, you'd certainly have enough political support to enact these reasonable measures that the great majority of Americans already support. And you got to do it nationwide. Got to do it in Congress. Yes, state laws matter and they make a difference, but as we know, guns fly across state lines. One of the statistics I point out in a repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America, is that in the tight gun control states, a lot of the guns used in crimes are coming from out of state, from loose gun control states. Whereas in the loose gun control states, the great majority of gun used in crimes come from within the states. It's pretty telling.
Well, I asked you about support in the Senate and the House, but how about Democratic candidates for president? They've all taken a tough stance on gun regulation to varying degrees, but have any of them embraced an all-out repeal of the Second Amendment?
Not that I know. You know, candidates tend to want to play it safe. And this is still I'm admitting it. This is a very controversial position, and I blame, I don't want to use the word blame, but I think in part the gun control movement and, you know, more liberal politics in America is to blame because they have, as I said, they're playing not to lose, they're not playing to win, And they fall into this trap of, we support the Second Amendment, but do you think that persuades the gun lobby? Oh, yeah, that's fine. Do you think that inspires anyone? Oh, yes, you know, chant, we support the Second Amendment, but, you know, that's our battle cry. Come on. It's no wonder that the gun control lobby, despite overwhelming public support, has been a loser for a quarter century. It's time for something new. It's time for a change.
Well, among the presidential candidates, who would you say comes closest to your position on gun control? Bloomberg?
Yeah, no question, Bloomberg. And, you know, he's been a very staunch advocate. More than any other candidate, he's made it a centerpiece of his campaign. And, as we know, money talks and hot air walks, and he's put his money behind it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Bloomberg would be a superb president on gun control. I'm not saying others wouldn't either. But if you had to pick one, it would be Bloomberg. He's obviously a long shot, though, for the nomination.
Well, while we're on the subject of the election, you've predicted the last 8 presidential elections, including 2016. Assuming that this president is not removed in the Senate impeachment, what are his reelection odds right now?
You know, I predict elections not using any conventional wisdom, which is often wrong, as it was in 2016.
Right.
But using my keys to the White House system, the 13 keys, and it takes 6 keys to count out, 6 negative keys to count out the party holding the White House. So elections essentially votes up or down on the strength and performance of the White House party. And right now, I have said the election's too close to call. The White House party, the Republicans, are down 4 to 5 keys, probably 5. It takes 6 to count them out. But a lot can happen between now and November. And in the age of Trump, as we know, things happen overnight.
Right.
So I'm not ready to make a prediction yet. A lot can still happen.
Yeah, interesting. And I think one of those keys was the economy, right?
That's right. And right now, 2 of my keys are on the economy.
Okay.
Trump wins both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not an economist. I'm not going to predict the economy. But there is at least some controversy among economists about the fact that the economy could take a slide this year. I'm not predicting that, but that's one of the things that could change, among many others.
And how much of this depends on who the alternative is?
Almost nothing.
Really?
I only have 1 key out of 13 that relates to the challenging party nominee, and it's a very narrow key.
Huh.
It says that key turns against the party holding the White House if and only if it's a truly inspirational, charismatic, once-in-a-generation candidate like Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama on the other side. So I always tell people, get rid of any thinking you have about electability. It's going to be wrong.
Interesting.
Just vote for who you believe in. You know, the Democrats thought they had solved electability. Pick a moderate, proven, experienced, credentialed candidate, and you're bound to win, like Mike Dukakis in 1988, Al Gore in 2000, John Kerry in 2004, Hillary Clinton in 2016. And what do they all have in common? They all lost.
So then you haven't gamed out who has the best shot among the Democrats of beating him, huh?
I won't.
You won't.
The only thing I would look for is, do we have a once-in-a-generational charismatic candidate? Issues, ideology, race, gender, none of those things matter. So if there's one word that I would eliminate from the political lexicon because it's so misused, it's electability. And again, my message to every voter is vote for who you believe in.
What do you think happened to the polls in 2016? Were Trump voters just not participating? Were they lying about their leanings? Or did just a lot of people suddenly change their minds in the 11th hour? What happened there?
Who knows? The problem is you should never use polls for prediction.
Mm-hmm.
Polls are not predictors for a couple of reasons, at least. Number one, they're snapshots. As you say, the polling data is obsolete the minute the poll is completed. They're just a snapshot at a point in time. They don't tell you what might happen subsequently. Secondly, the pollsters don't know who's actually going to vote. So they have to guess at what they call likely voters, but it's a guess, maybe an educated guess. So when they tell you the margin of error is plus and minus 3%, that's statistical error. That does not count errors produced by not getting it exactly right on who is going to vote and who isn't going
to vote. So are any polls in 2020 worth the paper they're printed on?
No, and certainly not the early polls.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Carter was trouncing Ronald Reagan at this time in 1980 and lost in a landslide. So if polls are of any value, it's only the very late polls. And even then, you know, take them with a big grain of salt. But polls, you know, 9-10 months out before an election aren't worth the printer ink. Let me make one other point. The reason we're so infatuated with polls is they seem like an election, but they're not. And they're easy. You know, if you're, you know, the journalists are all friends of mine. They're great. I'm not criticizing them. I'm talking about the system. It's really easy to write stories about the polls. You don't have to get out of bed in the morning, right? Just read the latest poll and write a story. It's like polls and money dominate the story because they're easy. You don't have to do anything.
Interesting. So part of it is lazy journalism, right?
Absolutely.
Well, once more, Alan Lichtman's latest book is called Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Professor Lichtman, thanks again for talking with me.
It was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thanks once more to Alan Lichtman for coming on the show. Order his new book, Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at Alan Lichtman. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.